Beatty Cohn-Vretos, and welcome again to the Ask Beatty Show. And as I was on the metro coming from the Upper West Side here in very, very hot, humid New York to the Progressive Radio Network studio, I was thinking, what would have happened if somebody like Jeffrey Epstein, or if the recent mass shooters, Connor Stephen Betts and Patrick Crucius from Allen, Texas, what would have happened if they had reached out for help early on, or if somebody early on in their life had recognized that things were really, really off track. I mean, the research that I've done about Connor Stephen Betts, and he was 24, lived in the Dayton suburb of Bellbrook. I mean, here was a kid. He was a kid who had significant issues. He had a rape list. He had a kill list. He had a lot of troubles in his past. He was bullied in high school. He had a plan to shoot up his high school. He was suspended for compiling a hit list of those he wanted to kill and a rape list of girls that he wanted to sexually assault. And there were a couple of suspensions. And apparently, the hit list in early 2012, it sparked a police investigation, and one-third of the students from Bellbrook, they skipped school out of fear of what Betts may or may not do. So here we have, he was a young boy. He had a lot of issues. There were red flags that were raised so many years ago. And yet, here was a guy. He was just able to go about his business and purchase an assault rifle that had multiple high-capacity magazines. And look at the damage. Look at the damage that happened as a result of his really never having received any help. Now, had he received help, you know, who knows exactly what the outcome would have been, but I suspect that he would not have been able to do the horrendous things, the killings, and of course he lost his own life as well in the mass shooting. And this is something that I think about all the time, is that we all have unfinished business. And typically, there are signs, there are symptoms that all is not well. And in the schools, we're able to identify the kids that are having trouble with peers, and the ones that are too quiet, and the kids that are bullying, and the kids that are being bullied, and the kids that are not doing well in school. And I think that we continue to just miss all kinds of opportunity for early identification and early intervention. And of course, I'm not talking about policing kids and about policing families. You know, when I think about Jeffrey Epstein, and we know very, very little about his early childhood. We know that he has a brother. We knew that he grew up in a Jewish working class family here in Brooklyn, New York. And you kind of wonder, and of course, as a psychotherapist and a sex therapist, when I start to treat people, the first place that I go is to the beginning. I go to people's family of origin. I want to understand, not that we can change history. I want to understand what happened and what didn't happen. And, you know, with Jeffrey Epstein, again, there is just nothing. There's been nothing in the media that I have been able to read about or to hear about that tells us anything at all about his early life. And, of course, one of the things that, you know, comes to mind is, was he sexually abused as a child? Many pedophiles were. And, again, it doesn't excuse, but we have to begin to have some kind of understanding about why people go off track in the ways that they go off track. You know, I was reading in the New York Times this morning, there were a number of letters to the editor probing the psyche of mass killers. And Dr. Richard A. Friedman, who is a very, very well-known and respected psychiatrist, this is the point he makes, and I have some issues with his point. And he says that he claims that studies of mass murderers illustrate that they are not necessarily mentally ill. Of course, it depends how we are defining mentally ill, but tend to be merely well-armed and filled with hate. And in my experience, even though I have not treated mass killers, I have treated a couple of people who have murdered. I think that there is much more to the story that they are simply well-armed and filled with hate. And Dr. Friedman observes, he says, the next mass killer is out there somewhere watching very carefully what we say and do to one another. And he may be as sane as you or me. Well, I don't think that the mass killers are as sane as you or me. And there was another letter from Dr. Martin, who happens to also be a psychiatrist, and he says nonsense. He says outside of the diagnosis in the psychiatric manual that we all use, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, many things may make someone, in quotes, abnormal. However, he says, mass murderers are not like you and me. They are outside of the norm. They may not have a DSM label, but they are tortured souls who've been brought up with hate and rigid thinking. Their developmental history, according to Dr. Martin, and of course I completely agree, is not normal. Their worldview is not normal. A label such as mental illness may not apply in the usual sense, but tortured and deviant mental development absolutely does. And there's another letter that says, what characterizes most, as Dr. Friedman understands, is not mental illness, but immersion in ideologies and often communities that promote a rigid separation between their own entitled state and others toward whom their rage will be directed. This fearful, rigid objectification allows violent extremists of many political and religious persuasions to cavalierly murder those whom they do not consider to be fully human. So the letter goes on to say that we need to counter this way of thinking and acting by offering convincing and emotionally stirring narratives and examples of inclusion by promoting mutual understanding and building community and being able to talk with people who do not share our political views and to be able to encourage dialogue. And another letter in the New York Times today was saying that the problem is that there will always be people as sane as you and me who are full of rage and hate, and we have easy access to a weapon of mass destruction to express their frustration. We must make such weapons less accessible. Well, of course, and I mean, we need to be talking. We absolutely need to be talking about gun control. We need to be talking about background checks. But we also need to be talking about economic inequality. We need to be talking about racism. We need to be talking about poverty. And in my view, we really need to be talking, and not just talking, about early intervention and early identification, because typically we see kids early on who are coming from families where things are really starting to get off track. And I've also and always really felt that the schools, I mean, we have an enormous opportunity in the school system. I mean, after all, we see the kids typically more than the parents see their kids. And we're able to see early on the kids that are really having difficulties, the kids that are struggling. And I think what typically happens, we wait for an explosion. There has to be a major crisis before people tend, A, to reach out and ask for help, and B, that people tend to then be referred for help. And I think that there's got to be a way. And I think it shouldn't be all that difficult that we make expressing feelings, whether or not they're feelings of guilt or upset or anger or pain, that we make the expression of these kinds of feelings really, really okay. And I think that if young children were allowed and if they were encouraged to get it all out when they have their fears and they have their worries and they have their issues, I think that we would see a very, very different kind of a society. I mean, I look at the depression statistics. In the United States, 16 million adults in the United States, which translates into 1 in 5 Americans, are suffering from depression. And 40 million adults are suffering from a variety of different anxiety disorders. I mean, we're stressed. People are really, I think, having a lot of issues these days. Jobs, money, all kinds of changes that are occurring in our society, politically and economically. And I think that people are having a very, very difficult time. And, you know, one of the primary reasons why I really love to do the Ask Beattie show is that I'm hoping that every single week that there may be some little thing that I might say that will give you a different perspective and perhaps will make it okay that I will be able to somehow give you permission that if you are struggling in your life, and we all struggle at different times in our life, whether or not we're rich or poor or therapist or black or white or gay or straight or Muslim or Jewish or Christian. And that one of the greatest things that I've seen over the past 35 years, and I've treated thousands of people of all ages and stages in life, is being able to really deal once and for all with issues, historical issues and current issues. It can really make all the difference in the world. I mean, I look at the divorce statistics, 48% of first marriages end in divorce, 63% of second marriages end up in the divorce court, 72% of third marriages. I look at three women are killed every single day. In the United States, 4 women are abused in every single day in their lifetime. So we're living in a society where things are tough, and I think that we need to be able to make some decisions about what are we going to do. And you know, my mantra has always been to acknowledge and address and resolve as best as we possibly can the issues, the old issues, the unfinished business, what I call the skeletons in the closet, problems stemming from our family of origins, including abuse of various different kinds, sexual abuse, sexual assault, verbal abuse, physical or emotional abuse. And even though we can't change our history, but we can, with a really good therapist, find a way to emotionally work through what did and did not happen in our lives so that we can finally free ourselves and give ourselves permission to be able to at last, instead of having 1 foot in the past and 1 foot in the present, to be able to be fully, fully present. And that doesn't mean that we're not going to experience pain that we sustained in our history, but being able to sort it all through and to be able to mourn what did and did not happen. Perhaps we were just unlucky and we grew up in a very abusive home. I mean, we're not going to be able to change that chapter in our life, but being able to process all of this emotionally really does free people up to finally be able to live their lives in the moment without constantly having one foot in the past and one foot in the present. You know, there was a piece in the New York Times that I really wanted to talk with you about, and the title of the article was "Your Sex Life After Menopause," and a new analysis gives voice to the many reasons it often falters with age for women. So for many women, according to Tara Parker Pope, sex after menopause is not as satisfying as it used to be. But is menopause entirely to blame? Of course, it is not entirely to blame. New research suggests that the hormonal changes that come with menopause are only a part of the reason a woman's sex life declines with age. You know, I think about some of the older women that I treated when I lived in Sarasota, Florida, women in their early to late 80s who were engaged in life in all kinds of ways, including having partners and including having very, very active sex lives. And while it's true that many women experience symptoms after menopause, including vaginal dryness, which we can actually do something about, painful intercourse and loss of desire, all of which can affect the frequency and pleasure of sex. But I think it is such a mistake to blame all of this on menopause. But the new study shows that the reasons many women stop wanting sex, enjoying sex, and having sex are far more complex. So while women traditionally have been blamed when sex wanes in a relationship, the research shows that often it is the health of a woman's partner that determines whether she remains sexually active and satisfied in her sex life. And typically, most studies have focused entirely on heterosexual women, so less is known about same-sex couples after menopause. But we do know that menopause seems to have a bad effect on libido, vaginal dryness, and sexual pain, says Dr. Stephanie Phobian. She is the director of the Mayo Clinic Center for Women's Health in Rochester, Minnesota. But what is coming up as a consistent finding is that the partner has such a prominent role, and it's not just the availability of the partner, it is the physical health of the partner as well. So here's a study. The latest study published in the medical journal Menopause is based on surveys of more than 24,000 women taking part in an ovarian cancer screening study in Britain. So the women ages 50 to 74 answered multiple choice health questionnaires about their sex lives at the start of this study. But the survey data are unique because about 4,500 of the women also left written comments, giving researchers a trove of new insights about women's sex lives. So what were some of the findings? Overall, 78% of the women surveyed said they had an intimate partner, but fewer than half the women, 49.2%, said that they had active sex lives. And the women's written answers about why they stopped having sex revealed the pain and sadness behind the percentages. So what were some of the reasons that these women, more than half of the women, stopped having sex even though they had an intimate partner? So the main reason was losing a partner to death or divorce, which was cited by 37% of the women. And women who were not having sex cited multiple reasons for the decline, which is why the percentage exceeded 100. So some of the comments: I've been a widow for 17 years. My husband was my childhood sweetheart. There will never be anyone else. Well, if she is okay with that, and this woman was age 72, then so be it. And I say oftentimes, you know, when I do marital therapy or couples therapy, and if both people are not interested in having sex, then there is not a problem. The problem, of course, typically happens when one does want to have an active sexual relationship and the other does not. But some women said that life was simply too complicated to make time for sex. 8% said that their partner was too tired for sex. Well, I think that that is a conversation that a couple certainly should be willing and able to have. And 9% of women said they were also too tired for sex. Well, who is to say that the only time that we should be thinking about having sex is at night at 10 or 11 o'clock at night? I mean, there are a lot of other opportunities. I mean, during the weekends. What about morning sex? What about early morning sex? What about afternoon sex? So I think that there's more to it than women saying that they were just simply too tired. One woman says, I feel my role in life at present is to bring up my 12-year-old son. Relationships come second. Not a great message. Not a great message to be communicating to your son. Children need to realize that adults have adult relationships. And I'm not necessarily suggesting that you're going to be, you know, having sex in front of your children. But kids need to understand that we as parents, we need our own lives. We need our own relationships. We need our own times. And that includes time for sexual and romantic relationships, of course, if that is what the couple is wanting. Other comments: caring for older parents at the present, lack of energy and worrying about them causes a reduction in sexual activity. And this was a woman who is just 53 years of age. And I think it becomes a question of a priority. And I think we can make a lot of excuses, and there's a lot of reasons why people stop having sex. And I'm going to go through some of the other reasons that have not at all been covered or dealt with in this article. And this is why I think that this article in many ways really does miss the boat to a degree. Other comments: husbands are busy with work and I am busy with two children. Both collapse into bed at the end of the day. And this is a woman of only 50 years of age. Of course, we have children and we're tired. And for years and years, you know, I have been hosting SBD radio shows and television shows now for over 25 years. And I find myself, I am this broken record, and I'm continually talking about the importance of keeping the couple at the top of the list of priorities. We do not do our children any favors at all if we allow our homes to become completely child-oriented. Other comments: a husband with serious health issues was another common theme, and about one in four women, 23%, said that the lack of sex was because of their partner's physical problems, and 11% of women blamed their own physical problems as well. So if we're talking about sex, what are we really saying? Are we talking about intercourse? Are we talking about manual stimulation? Are we talking about oral sex? I mean, there are a variety of different things that we are able to do if we choose to do it, if we are interested interested in remaining sexual beings. And if you're not, I mean, that's okay too. But let's not blame. Let's not pretend that all of these other issues are the primal reasons and primal causes of our lack of sexual desire. And I'm going to go a lot deeper with all of this. Other comments. He does not maintain erection strong enough for penetration. Okay, so there are a lot of other things that you can do if you are dealing with somebody who has erectile dysfunction. And another woman says, my sexual activity is limited by what my husband's health is. Well, I mean, there are ways to talk about this and there are ways around it, including giving yourself permission to use sex toys, to watch porn if you are comfortable doing this alone or with your husband. And, you know, what's interesting, too, in this article, you know, we're really talking about couples. Now, there are more and more people who are not in a couple situation, and still to assume that because somebody is single or they're not in a relationship that they are not having sex or that they should not want to have sex and they are not entitled to have sex, of course, is absolutely absurd. And I think that people should be encouraged to masturbate, to use sex toys if that is something that they want to do to keep their sexual desire and to keep their sex life alive, whether you have a partner or whether you are solo. Other comments, my husband had a heart attack. Other people are citing mental health and addiction kinds as the reason for lack of sex. So my question, of course, is what are you going to do about this? Are you going to remain silent, or are you and your partner going to be willing to acknowledge, address, and resolve the addiction issue, if that is the issue that we're talking about right now, over and above talking about the impact that the mental health and addiction issue is having on your sex life or lack of. Woman of 56 says he drinks approximately 1 to 1.5 bottles of whiskey a day. Well, that is going to numb him out, and that is going to cause more than just sexual problems with this particular couple. Another woman is talking about her husband's anxiety. About 30% of women said that their sex lives had halted because they had no interest. And of course, as a woman, I need to find out, what is that all about? What is this no interest all about? Other comments, I've lost all interest and feel guilty. And that makes me avoid any mention of it at all. So we have a communication issue. We have a guilt issue that needs to be dealt with. Several symptoms of the menopause have affected my desire for sex, which I find disappointing. So there needs to be some conversations with the gynecologist. I find it uncomfortable and sometimes painful. I use vaginal gels, but it doesn't help much. So again, these are conversations to have with your gynecologist, with your doctor, and also with your partner. I love my partner very much. This problem upsets me. However, if I didn't have a partner, I wouldn't miss it. And I'll tell you something, I am hearing this more and more in my own practice. You know, I'm thinking about women in their 40s and 50s and 60s. Actually, these particular women do have partners, and yet they are telling me that they're basically doing it so that their partners will be satisfied and that their own libidos happen to be very low. And these are issues that we're really trying to explore, you know, what it is about. You feel physically attracted to somebody, you say that you love somebody, what is going on with your libido? So that we need to be researchers and figure out what is the issue, and of course, much more importantly, what we need to do about it. 21% of the women said that their partners had lost interest in sex. Again, these are conversations. These are conversations that couples really need to happen. What happens if one partner loses interest and another one has not lost interest? There is a couple issue that does need to be discussed, and there needs to be hopefully some kind of win-win resolution. Other comments. Sex happens less often than when you're younger. We both get tired, but when we do, it's good. And this was a woman who is 64. And I think that, you know, what I've found over the years is that the more you do it, the more you are going to want to do it. But I need to address some of the other issues that I have found really get in the way of people's sex life. And let's begin with mental health issues. So that if you are feeling depressed or anxious and you are not getting any relief from your depression or anxiety, the last thing you're probably really going to want to do is jump into bed and have sex, although that could prove to be an amazing anti-anxiety and antidepressant for yourself. Or if you have not dealt with early traumas, and early traumas including sexual assault, early child sexual abuse, these are things that typically always, always get in the way. And I remember treating, you know, many, many women over the years, you know, who've said that the very, very things that were done to them when they were sexually abused as children were the very things, understandably so, that they were not able to tolerate as adults. So that if you are someone listening to the Ask Beaty show right now who has been sexually abused or sexually assaulted or has had any trauma at all around sex, I mean, these are things that can be successfully dealt with, even though we cannot change, unfortunately, what happened or what did not happen to you in your earlier life. So the trauma, you know, traumatic events, they do need to be dealt with. We can't pretend, you know, people will say, well, that happened in the past. It happened 15 years ago, 20 years ago. The trauma remains with us unless we find a way, and typically with really, really good help, to emotionally work through the trauma that we sustained. And this can be done with really good therapy. And I do not at all want to suggest that this is going to take years and years and years to deal with the issues. But I think that looking the other way is never going to help and is never going to resolve any issue of any kind, whether or not we're talking about trauma, whether or not we're talking about addiction, whether or not we're talking about any other kind of mental health problem. And, you know, something that was not mentioned in this article, and by the way, I actually sent Tara Parker Pope an email. I thought that she would be a really terrific, terrific guest to have on the show. I haven't heard back from her yet, but I really do want to pursue it. I like her writing. I like the subject matter that she deals with. But, you know, something else that's really important is that if your relationship is not in a good place, if you are not feeling close to your partner, if you are angry, if you are disappointed, if you are continually upset and you feel disrespected, the very last thing that the majority of women are going to want to do is jump into bed and have sex with somebody who they may feel furious, furious toward. So again, it comes back to the willingness of people to find a way, even if they need to reach out and ask for help. And of course, that is not a weakness. It is a strength, so that you can get yourself and you can get your relationship really back on track. Other things, of course, that were mentioned, hormones, and as we get older, for men, of course, we know that the testosterone levels diminish, and they can diminish significantly. But also, the testosterone and the estrogen levels for women also do plummet, particularly after menopause. And there are a number of different natural remedies that I think that women can, you know, look into over and above the typical prescriptions that the doctors typically write that will help hormonally. Because certainly if you're having dryness and if you're having, you know, pain with intercourse, you do not want to put yourself in a situation where you are in a painful position. So again, whether or not we're talking about sex, whether or not we're talking about depression, whether or not we are having issues in our relationship, when problems arise and that you feel like you're really on a roller coaster ride, and it's not a fun roller coaster ride or not a fun merry-go-round, I can't think of anything else that would make sense other than giving yourself permission to reach out and ask for help. You know, I'm looking at the, we have a voicemail line here where you are actually able to leave questions and comments for the various different hosts here on the Progressive Radio Network. And the voicemail line is 862-800-6805. So voicemail line number is 862-800-6805. So that, you know, for my show, if you have any comments and we can agree to disagree, we can dialogue, I can answer any questions that you might have about your relationship, about your sex life, about any mental health issues. So, remember that number, 862-800-6805. You know, we're talking about unfinished business or skeletons in the closet. Last week in the New York Times, there was a huge article in the style section. They're mad as hell. So I'm looking, and here are four women in their 60s and beyond, and I'm going to read you a couple of their comments. Tony Tooney had been at her job at a small employment agency for no more than a week, cold calling prospective clients, when, as she tells it, her boss sidled up demanding in the argot of the day that she put out or get out. Mrs. Tooney, a retired clinical psychologist in her 70s, was 23 at the time and panicky. We were in a recession, she recalled. Jobs were hard to come by. In those days, I had to scramble to buy groceries. No matter, she left. So she had the courage, and it certainly would have taken a lot of courage given the economic situation to leave. Stuff like that, she says, happens a lot. Even today, it scares me to think of it. And as for her boss, she says, I will never forget him. Then in a burst of long-suppressed rage, she named him. And good for her. Because some, it would seem, and I think many of us have read about E. Jean Carroll, who says that she was sexually assaulted by no other than Donald J. Trump. And this is what she says. She says that it happened as if, or it felt that it happened just even a month ago. What do we need men for? A chronicle of abuses, she says, that she suffered at the hands of predators. So there were more than just Donald J. Trump. At the hands of predators, including the accusation that Trump assaulted her in the lingerie department of Bergdorf Goodman. And for some reason, she says she prefers not to use the word rape. Miss Carroll waited more than two decades to tell the tale, which Mr. Trump has obviously denied. And was there something self-serving or opportunistic in her late life disclosure? And I think a lot of people would ask that question. I think it's an erroneous question, but it's a question that I can understand that people would pose. And she says, well, no, I'm a member of the silent generation. We do not flap our gums. We laugh it off and get on with life. Well, that may have been the way a lot of women were programmed to behave historically, but more and more, and thanks to the Me Too movement and Time's Up, that more and more women, they are saying enough is enough. We are going to speak out. We are going to file lawsuits, and we are no longer going to internalize any kind of abuse that we may have sustained. And I think what's true is that the Me Too movement has really lent some older women permission to be able to speak out in a way that they hadn't before. And some of these women are just now playing catch up with their outspokenness daughters and nieces and granddaughters and with their younger selves. And it is all good. And the movement is infectious. They can release the hurts that they've lived with finally all these years in ways that are vindicating. And that is one of the really important things that we all need to take in when it comes to dealing with our unfinished business, whether or not it's with our parents, whether or not it's with our grandparents, whether or not it is current business, whether or not it is old business, to be able to find a way not only to emotionally work through what did and did not happen, but also certainly if people are alive, and we're seeing more and more that women are challenging their perpetrators in the courts. And what we're seeing online, younger women feel that they are instantly heard. Well, we're certainly heard a lot more instantly than it was in the past. And that gives us a feeling of power. And older women did not feel that they had that release in their past. So what's happened is that wrath begets wrath. Outrage is very media friendly these days, and still for generations brought up to smile in the face of almost any affront or risk being tarred, as harried-in older women's indignation seems ripe for reassessment, and it is certainly about time. So we have small wonder then that with careers, social constraints, and family obligations mostly behind them, some have seen fit to go rogue. And I think it is so empowering, whether or not it's dealing with parents who were abusive to us or neglectful to us in a variety of different ways, or for people who may have sexually assaulted or sexually harassed us, to be able to finally feel comfortable enough to take a stand and do whatever it is that we need to do, as long as we are operating within the legal system. So we're not going to put ourselves in any kind of situation that's going to be destructive or self-destructive or self-sabotaging. Because so many of the older women, you know, they were saying, and particularly in this article, I needed people to like me, even though I didn't particularly like them. Now, if they like me or not, who gives a damn? This particular woman was quoted. And conventional wisdom may dictate that a woman past 60, I mean, 60, that is young. I don't know why we're talking about women past 60 as if 60 is old. ought to be settled in her metaphoric rocker, basking in her sunset years. But there can be rewards in sorting out old grievances. There are always rewards. Emotional rewards, sometimes financial rewards, certainly psychological rewards for sorting out old grievances, which seem in any case to have no expiration date at all. And so I think that this is a really important message that women are starting to really deal with. You know, another woman is quoted in this piece. She says, "I'm still furious, still dealing with that residual rage." Well, all I can tell you as a psychotherapist that there are really constructive ways to be dealing with your residual rage, with your residual depression, with your residual upset, whether or not the upsets occurred today or yesterday or 15 or 25 or even 40 or 50 years ago. And, you know, somebody was saying in this piece that looking back on those earlier years, you know, she said that we swallowed a pile of garbage. And I think that was the way we had the whole patriarchal system set up, and people played by the rules. And I think that many, many women, that they felt that they had absolutely no way out at all but to go along. And for much of people's careers, you know, women were saying that they sacrificed their needs and opinions to those of other people. But you know what's interesting is that self-assurance, that is no bulwark against the depreciation of age. And for some, the culprit is nature itself. You know, this woman was quoted as saying, "I'm an angrier person than ever before." And she says, "I can't blame it on Trump. I blame it on chemistry, on my arthritis, and on the stark reminders of my mortality." Well, I think that a lot of people, we can get very angry about the reality of life and the reality of death. But I think that what is really important when we're talking about unfinished business, or if we're talking about skeletons in the closet, and I'm going to ask you, I mean, for those of you who are listening right now, are there people in your life, past or present, that you have some issues with, that for a variety of reasons you were not able to confront them, you were not able to talk with them about what did or did not happen at various different points in your life? And you have to be honest with yourself, and you also have to ask yourself, in not dealing with these issues and in not confronting these people directly. Now, of course, some people do not need to confront. Some people need to emotionally work through, and they could do this with a therapist, and that they feel good enough about the situation that that occurred or did not occur in their history. But if you are someone who has unfinished business, or what you would call skeletons in your closet, and the person is still alive, the person is still around, you know, you need to be able to give yourself permission, if you so desire, and figure out a plan now what it is that you would like to do. Of course, a lot of women are suing for sexual abuse, for rape, for sexual assault. But even in your own family, let's say you grew up in a family where there was verbal abuse or neglect or physical abuse, and that you've never had, for a variety of reasons, the time or the courage to be able to sit down and confront your perpetrators. And for those of you who are in a position right now who feel the time has come, I've sucked it up for long enough, and I feel ready now, without any expectation that the person is going to apologize, or without any expectation at all that the person is even going to acknowledge what they did or did not do historically. But I have a need. I have a need to contact this person and confront them. And if you are in this place in your life, I'm the one that wants to then give you permission to, as just long as you're doing it in a way that you're going to be safe and that you're not going to be doing anything that will be destructive or self-sabotaging in any way, that you need to do it. And in fact, it reminds me of a patient that I actually treated in Providence, Rhode Island. And this young man had been sexually abused by his father for most of his childhood. And he was placed as a young child in a monastery with priests. And the priests actually took off where the father had stopped. So he spent most of his life as a victim of early child sexual abuse. So when I first met him, you can imagine he was depressed, to say the least. He was drinking too much. He was using a variety of different recreational drugs and over-medicating himself. And he decided at one point in our therapy that he was going to go to Florida, which is where his father was living, and that he was going to confront him. And the father also had been extremely, extremely physically abusive to his mother and to his siblings. And at age, I think at the time, Ed was probably in his early 50s, he made the decision that this was time for him to confront his father. So what did he do? He got in his car and he drove all the way to Florida, and he found out, of course, these days with the internet, it was easy enough to find out where the father lived. And he knocked on the door, and there was nobody there. And he waited around for a while and came back to the house, and there was nobody there. So what he did was that he wrote a letter, and he put the letter in the father's mailbox, telling him all the things that he had obviously never been able to tell him as a child or as an adult. He got into his car and he drove all the way back to Providence, Rhode Island. I remember when we met a few days after his return, he said, you can't believe the catharsis that I am now able to experience, that even though I did not see my father face to face, I said everything that I felt that I needed and wanted to say in the letter, and there was no longer, it was interesting, there was no longer a need at all for him to try to pursue seeing his father or talking to his father. And that did the trick for this particular man. So again, there's many, many different ways that we can deal with old issues and old relationships, including, face-to-face confrontation. But the point about dealing with our unfinished business and our skeletons in the closet is that unless we find a way to do it successfully, as I mention all the time, we do continue to have one foot in the past and one foot in the present. So that if there are any people in your life at all, who you feel that you have some things that you haven't been able to talk to them about in the past, again, remembering that, ideally, people who have hurt us, people who have disappointed us, we would love to confront them and have them say to us, I'm so sorry. It was this. It was some other reason, but I am so sorry that I hurt you and that I was not there for you. But very, very frequently, that is not the kind of response that you are going to get. So it really needs to be about you taking that kind of concerted action without any real expectations. It's about getting it out so that you are not going to continue to repress and suppress feelings that are getting in the way of your life and your relationship. You know, I'm looking at the stack of articles that I have that I really wanted to talk with you about today, but we're going to have to wait for another week. And I want to thank you all so much for listening and for emailing and for texting. And I'm hoping that today that I did say something significant that will help you live more fully and have a better day today and tomorrow. So again, thanks so much for listening. I'll talk with you next week.